I have a message from another time. Aerie Productions Unlimited presents Undocumented Features Future Imperfect Symphony of the Sword As a Lynn's Winter Holiday by Benjamin D. Hutchins. Hi, that's me. Asselin Devere Natoshkin was bored. Really bored. It was Christmas Day, 2404, and she was lying on her bed in room 212 of Sanford Riley Hall, the oldest and nicest of the Worcester Preparatory Institute's dormitories. Well, not oldest, technically. They were all the same age, the place having been rebuilt from bedrock up, along with the rest of Worcester County, after the WDF's unfortunate visit to the area in the 1990s. Still, the original Riley Hall had been the original WPI's oldest dorm, and the style was the same. It had high pre-air-conditioning ceilings, big windows, creaky hardwood floors. It was a bit drafty and cost the school more to heat and cool than any other building on campus. But it had character. It also had one very bored student who had managed to wangle permission to remain on campus during the customary Christmas holiday clean-out because it took a week and a half to get from Earth to Dantroff by hypership and she couldn't afford anything faster. Caitlin Hutchins's family would probably have been more than happy to give her a ride, or even pay her way on a better class of Starliner. They were an absurdly generous bunch. But Asselin disliked the idea of presuming that way on their friendship. For that matter, she could have gone to New Avalon with Kate herself, if she had asked. She'd been there once before, for a couple of days in the middle of the last summer break, and thoroughly enjoyed herself. But no. She had considered inviting herself, but something had clearly happened between Kate and her roommate Utena Tenjo during those last few days before the start of winter break, while Kate was nursing Utena back to health from her brush with the flu. Whatever it was, it had brought the two of them closer together, and Asselin, who always rejoiced to see bonds between people strengthening, had decided they were better left to themselves and Kate's family for the holidays. A beginning is a delicate time, after all, and this was plainly the beginning of a new stage of the roommate's friendship. So Asselin was here, the only person on campus but for plant services and one lonely network operations tech watching over the school's internet feed, and bored. She was accustomed to amusing herself for long periods of time, requiring only 2 hours or so of sleep per night gave her more free time than most of her fellows. But she'd been at it now for 2 days, and it was getting to be more than a little tedious. She hadn't any work to do, she hadn't any place to go, she was running out of things to reread, and everything, from the dining hall to both the school and city libraries, was closed today. She could sleep for more than that. She could sleep for entire days, if necessary, and then use the banked energy to remain awake for days afterward. But if she did that, she'd just be more bored when the time came to use up the rest she'd accrued. Unless she stayed in bed for the whole vacation, then didn't sleep for most of C-term. That might be fun just for the reactions of some of her friends, but it would drive her roommate completely mad if she didn't at least get her usual 2 hours. She looked from her half of room 212, with its chaotic jumble of books, clothes, and random other items, to the other half. The division was as sharp as if there had been a wall there, right in the center of the room. The other side was neat, orderly, Spartan, the few personal items there arranged with the standard-issue furniture into a militarily precise tidiness, like a stateroom aboard a ship. Asselin missed the creature that had created that rigid order. For all that her roommate, Amanda Dessler, was unlike her, they had a certain chemistry that had made them best friends despite their differences. After all, they had been thrown together by the housing computer the first year, but not this one. Amanda kept her half of the room the way she liked it, and didn't harass Asselin for keeping hers the way she liked it. Asselin lay on her back, put her hands behind her bushy gray head, and sighed. She could have gone with Amanda, too, but she'd had the suspicion that, best friends or not, there wouldn't be much fun to be had on Gamelon. She rather liked Amanda's brother Garon. But the two Desslers saw each other so rarely nowadays that when they did, they didn't have much time for anybody else. And Asselin disliked being an extra wheel. She didn't grudge Amanda her time with Garon by any means, love in all its forms, was sacred to Azalin. But she knew it meant she'd find Gamelon even duller than this. Nobody else on that planet was any fun at all. She could definitely not have gone with Moose, for though she was quite welcome wherever he went, the gravity on Hoffman was something like 3 standard Gs, and that would just not do. Azalin was energetic, but not that energetic. Not without a fusion-powered exoskeleton, anyway. Of the members of the Institute Band Geeks Federation, that left Devlin, and she couldn't have accompanied him on his vacation because she had no idea where he'd gone. He didn't talk about his home life, or what he did on breaks, simply came and went, and was never quite himself for the first day or so when he returned. Azalin worried a bit about that, but the time had never seemed right for her to try asking him about it. These things had their own schedule, to which she was sensitive, but not privy. When the time came, if it did, she would know, but she couldn't predict when it might. She sighed. Now she was getting maudlin. It was only 2:30 in the afternoon, for pity's sake. Much too early for that kind of thing. She wondered where Edward Tivruski had wandered off to. But then, Ed wasn't actually a student, and so her comings and goings were random and varied at all times, not just during vacations. Azalin got up and paced around the room, crossing the invisible dividing line into Amanda's domain. For a while, she sprawled on her roommate's neatly made bed, too light to disturb the covers by lying on them. Among the many things about Amanda which she liked was the Gamelon's scent, a subtle combination of sweetness, bitterness, and danger that nicely summarized the girl herself. Humans always seemed to think that kind of thing was weird, but Azalin couldn't see how it was any different from liking the way a person looked or sounded, and anyway, she was used to being considered weird by humans. She took a little nap there for perhaps 10 minutes, then got up and stretched and left the room in search of adventure, collecting her winter clothes on the way. That wasn't very likely, in Worcester, on Christmas Day, but she wasn't going to find it locked in her room. It was a cold and blustery day, but Azalin didn't mind that much. She had a warm coat, a Federation Starfleet surplus field parka, which was a size or so too big for her slender frame, and good stout boots. She preferred to go barefoot, but even her tough feet couldn't hack a Worcester winter. She exited the front of Riley Hall, stood for a moment at the top of the stoop with her hands in her parka pockets, surveying the empty faculty parking lot and the bare trees and snowy expanse of the quad. An hour or so of daylight left. What to do, what to do. The CCC was closed. The library was closed. The dining halls, the Wedge snack bar, and Gompe's pub in the Riley basement were closed. The whole city of Worcester was closed, except for one Chinese restaurant, which was an inconvenient distance away on foot. She supposed the Worcester Regional Transit Authority's buses. For the first few days of her WPI career, she had supposed WRTA was a radio station, being advertised on the buses. Would be running at least a limited schedule today, but she'd never really bothered to learn their routes or timetables. Azalin decided to walk up to Bancroft Tower just for the sake of something to do. She pulled the hood of her parka up over her head to keep her ears from freezing, stuck her hands back in her pockets, and walked around the end of Riley Hall to Institute Road, then down the hill, across Park Avenue, all but deserted, and up the next hill. Down the hill and up the next hill was pretty much how one walked anywhere in Worcester. As opposed to its neighbor, Institute Hill, which had, of course, the Institute on it, Bancroft Hill was residential, covered in winding, narrow streets, some of them very poorly maintained, pavement-wise, and large, pleasant, expensive-looking houses. Azalin navigated the maze of little streets without error or concern, climbing ever nearer to the top of the hill, until finally she passed into an area of woods. Just like that, she could have been miles from any city. The change, both in appearance and atmosphere, was remarkable as she passed one last lone house at the point of a sweeping, climbing left-hand turn, and proceeded to the tower. As towers went, Bancroft Tower was, she supposed, not terribly impressive. It was a 2-story building shaped rather like an inverted U, made of random stones mortared together to give it a craggy exterior that invited climbing. On the left side, as one faced it, a crenellated turret jutted up a further story. It had several narrow barred windows on 2 levels, and inside the legs of the U were iron bar doors blocking entrance into the two halves of the tower itself. Still, it was interesting looking, and having it here in the middle of the city, yet surrounded by this grassy, tree-lined area that looked so far from an urban environment, made it exotic and gave it a mysterious air. Looming up against the gray sky, just short of twilight, it looked rather sinister. Azalin, who was not given to apprehension, passed between the two little turrets that flanked the paved walkway up to the tower, walking right up to the tower itself. The barred doors were secured with modern electrolocks, one of the few concessions to progress made by the city's historical society over the years in an attempt to help the Worcester Police Department better keep the public out of the tower's gloomy interior. They seemed to work fairly well. Reports of people being in the tower, or at least being caught there, were rare. It took Azalin a few moments to notice that the left-hand one, under the side of the tower with the turret, had been forced. Electrolock or not, it was still just an old iron door. Her interest piqued, Azalin flipped back her hood and went inside. It was dark inside Bancroft Tower. There were no lights, so the only illumination came from the dim gray sunlight filtering through the narrow barred windows. Azalin didn't mind that. She could see in the dark, albeit only in black and white. The room at the left side of the tower's base wasn't really a room at all, just a wide, shallow-stepped stone staircase, leading away to the far wall, then doubling back on itself upward. She sniffed the air. Somebody was here, or had been here very recently. Cautiously, she made her way up the stairs to the second landing. It doubled back on itself twice more before reaching the top. Nothing halfway up but dust and silence, but... Azalin paused. Above her, she could hear someone breathing. Well, actually, what made him... wrong pitch for a woman, and the scent wasn't right for that either. Audible was the fact that he was shivering while breathing, but why pick nits? At this point, most people would have left the tower, perhaps called the police. Azalin, however, was too curious about who could possibly be lurking in Bancroft Tower on Christmas Day without, apparently, adequate protection from the cold. It seemed to her that if you were going to go committing simple trespass on city property, that was fine, but you ought to bring a coat or wait until it was warmer. She climbed the stairs to the turret room. This was a larger room, spanning the top of the U. It actually felt more like three rooms, since it was barbell-shaped, the narrow section in the middle pinched further by a pair of open doorways at each end. It was scattered with trash, fast food wrappers, empty beer containers, used contraceptives, evidence that others had been up here before. That kind of thing annoyed Azalin, who felt that if you were going to trespass, you might at least have the decency to clean up after yourself, and she found herself scowling faintly as she topped the stairs and looked around for the source of the noise. There was someone up here, all right, though she couldn't see much of him. He was huddled against the wall near the first doorway, sitting on the floor, his knees drawn up, shivering. His hands held something long and narrow across his knees. Without better light, all she could really tell was that he was humanoid, fairly young-looking by his build, and had a lot of hair, which hung down from his bowed head to spill over his hands and whatever he was holding. He didn't look up when she came the rest of the way up the staircase and into the room itself. "Hey," she said, and then a little louder, "Hey, are you okay?" He didn't respond. She moved closer, crouching down to get a better look, and put a hand on his shoulder, shaking slightly. "Hey," she said a third time. He looked up at her, his eyes snapping open, and she got a momentary impression of gaunt haggardness and haunted pain before he lunged to his feet with a sudden, startling, explosive energy. The object he'd been holding made a long, silvery scraping noise, then half of it fell to the littered floor with a wooden clatter as the other half gleamed in the dull, failing daylight. "Oh, it's you," said Azalin, backing away through the narrow part, not sounding too concerned. "Where'd you get another sword?" He stared at her with wild eyes, his pupils shrunken even in the gloom of this place, his chest heaving from the surprise, and panted, "You know her?" Then he blinked, recognizing her. Yes, he answered himself. I saw you with her before they left. Where did they go?
Home, you fool, Azalin replied. It's Christmas. Listen, you don't look so good. If you promise to behave, I'll get you some soup or something.
I don't want soup, he barked,
then stumbled back against the wall as a fit of coughing overran him.
Real concern touched Azalin's heart. This guy was trouble. He'd attacked Utina the previous week without any provocation at all, while she was reeling with the flu, no less, then disappeared from where Caitlin had left him unconscious and bleeding on the quad before the campus police could show up and take him away. It wasn't concern for herself, Azalin felt, though, but for him. He must be freezing his ass off up here, dressed in tattered rags, and his injuries from his duel with Kate hadn't been tended. She didn't like to see anybody suffering like that, even a sword-waving crazy with a mad on for one of her friends.
Home. Tenja would have no home in this place, wherever we are. He grated as he recovered his balance and stood, wobbling slightly, glaring at Azalin. Her only home was the academy. The other girl.
He racked his memory, dredged up the name he'd seen on the sign on Morgan 412's door.
Hutchins. They went to her home?
Uh-huh, said Azalin, nodding. Look, you're really in no shape to be waving that thing around. Why don't you put it down and we'll go someplace warm and talk about this?
He smiled at her coldly, his eyes glittering in the twilight.
You will take me there, he hissed.
Azalin stared at him in disbelief for several seconds, then burst out laughing. He blinked at her, startled. This was certainly not the reaction he'd been expecting.
Pal, said Azalin when she got control of her breathing back, if I could take you there, I'd have gone home for the holidays myself. Now put that thing down before you fall on it, she added, more seriously, gesturing to the sword.
Instead of doing that, he snarled and lunged for her, anger giving him sudden strength. The blade slashed through the air with an audible hiss, coming for her. She wasn't there. He stopped, pivoted, saw her standing a couple of feet away, near the stairway up. With a growl, he lunged again, and again she eluded him, darting up the stairs. He charged after her, out onto the snow-covered roof.
Look, she said. He lunged a third time, his blade wanging with a burst of sparks off the stone parapet that ringed the roof.
Hey, said Azalin, halfway across the roof. He roared with frustration, diving for her. She jumped over his next swing, avoided the next to the left, the next to the right. All the while she was dodging, flicking herself out of his path with inches to spare, she kept trying to talk to him, but he kept snarling and attacking, his face getting darker and darker. Azalin realized that, if she didn't stop him soon, he was probably going to pass out, or worse. So on his next attack, a wild overhand cut, she put herself right in his path, slapped her palms together on either side of his blade, and wrenched it out of his hands to clang off the parapet and vanish over the side.
Look, she said, and she grabbed his shoulders, got a foot behind him, and bore him down to the roof on his back, her knees pinning his elbows.
Calm down before you hurt yourself, she ordered him, her golden eyes flashing. He struggled, but to no avail. She wasn't very heavy, but she had the mechanical advantage. Snarling, he tried to gather himself and heave her off, but just then their eyes met. The irritated compassion in hers seemed to spark against something behind his, and his enraged fugue snapped like a broken icicle. He slackened, not fighting. Without the fight burning in him, another fit of shivering overcame him, and he soon found himself unable to do much of anything but lie there being cold.
See, said Azalin, shaking her head. You're almost certainly hypothermic. How long have you been up here?
Three days,
he replied, teeth chattering.
Idiot, said Azalin.
She got up off him, grabbed his hands, and hauled him unsteadily to his feet.
Lean on me, she said, slinging his arm over her shoulders. Let's see if we can do the stairs without killing ourselves. What's your name, by the way?
I'm Azalin.
Kyoichi, he stammered,
Kyoichi Sayanji.
Okay, Kyoichi, said Azalin as she steered him onto the top step. Let's get you warmed up, and then we can talk about why you're a homicidal wacko who hates my friends. She took him back to Riley Hall, where else was she going to take him, and sent him into the boys' bathroom on the first floor with a towel, a bar of soap, a bottle of shampoo, a first aid kit, and the only clothes she could scrounge up that would fit him. While he showered, she wondered if he would actually come back to the room once he was done, or if he'd slip away back out into the gathering night. She rather doubted the latter. If nothing else, she still had his sword, which she'd gathered up as they left the tower. And a nice sword it was, too. Azalin wasn't as familiar with blades as, say, Kate or Amanda, but she knew quality steel when she held it, and this was a good sword. A Japanese tachi with a nice clear temper line and embellishments that looked and felt like real gold. Something about it felt authentic, old and powerful. She wondered where he'd acquired it, when he apparently hadn't had the wherewithal to get new clothes or a bath or treatment for his injuries. She lay back on her bed, sighed, and wondered what sort of mood he'd be in when he got back from the shower. That mood was, apparently, bemused. Half an hour later, he came back to the room and knocked, just like a regular person, and she went and let him in, alert but not particularly wary. He still looked cold, but with his long green hair clean and the blood and dirt washed off his face, he was considerably more presentable. He had interesting eyes, an unusual pale shade of violet. Azalin found herself wanting to like him, even though he had shown nothing so far but violence and anger toward her and her friends. "Feel better?" she asked him. "Yes," he replied, his tone subdued. He looked down at himself with a puzzled expression, and she had to admit there was reason for it. He did look a bit odd, dressed in a dark blue, pocket-covered jumpsuit with several blank Velcro patches on it where military insignia had recently been removed. The jumpsuit itself was a most remarkable garment. Through a clever series of hidden straps, zippers, and folds, it could be adjusted to fit a range of body types, for men considerably bigger than Sayanji, down to the diminutive girl who'd given it to him. Maybe even smaller, he hadn't experimented that much. "What am I wearing?" he asked. "One of my roommate's flight suits," Azalin replied. "Neat, aren't they? All the rage these days, if you're a space fighter pilot."
"Space fighter," Sayanji replied, looking even more confused than before. Then he yawned, wobbling a little on his feet.
"Tired?" Azalin asked. He nodded. "Well, get some sleep, then," she said, indicating her bed. With a strange look, he went to it, sat down on the edge, and regarded her for several seconds.
"Why are you doing this?" he asked in a quiet voice.
"It's Christmas," she replied. "I was bored. You have nice eyes." She shrugged. "Pick one." He looked silently at her, his puzzlement only deepening, but she didn't show any signs of elaborating, so he got under the covers and tried to go to sleep. As exhausted as he was, it didn't take long. When he awoke, it was still dark outside the window, and the room was mostly dark as well, lit only by the glow of a computer display. Azalin sat at Amanda's desk, across the room, her back to Sayanji, absorbed in whatever the display was showing her. He frowned, glancing to the back of the other desk's chair, right next to the bed in which he lay. His sword was slung over the corner of its upright back by the scabbard cord. Stupid creature. If he were of a mind to, he could end her before she even knew what had hit her. Fortunately for her, he wasn't. What was he of a mind to do? Was he of a mind to do anything? After a long, hot shower and several hours of sleep under this extremely warm and comfortable quilt and comforter combination, he still felt cold. And he was hungry, he suddenly realized. Very hungry. When was the last time he ate anything of significance? Had it been before he came here? Wherever here was. He couldn't dredge it up.
His memory seemed all right on a casual glance back, but delving into it for any specific fact made it dissolve, like the reflection on a pool of water when a hand is thrust into it. He sat up and pressed the heels of his hands to his eyes, groaning. Ezelin swiveled. "Headache?" she asked. "No," he replied. "Not exactly." "Hungry?" she asked. "Yes," he replied. "Very." She considered for a moment. "Well, what the hell," she said. "It's still Christmas." She turned back to the table, picked up the telephone, and called a cab. "Where are we going?" Sayanji wondered. "The only place in this town that's open," Azalin replied, lacing up her boots. That place was a restaurant called Ping's Garden, downtown near the bus station. The guy that ran the place seemed to know Azalin, unless he just greeted everybody with that exuberant good cheer. He didn't seem to be upset that he was seating customers at 10 o'clock on Christmas night. Sayanji had no idea what any of this place's food was, so he let Azalin order. It seemed to him that she ordered a lot of food for just the two of them, but he supposed the portion size might be small here. Still, the list seemed rather long for dinner for two. While they sipped tea and waited for their food, he and Azalin regarded each other across their corner booth, he uneasily, she with a frank but unreadable expression. Her golden eyes bored into him, making him feel faintly uneasy. He wondered what she could be thinking of him. She was a remarkable-looking creature. He'd never seen anyone quite like her, with her wiry, dull silver hair, peculiarly reflective liquid gold eyes, and dark, coppery skin. There was a strangely feline cast to her features. The pupils of her eyes were odd, too. And was it his imagination, or were her canine teeth a bit too pronounced? Sayanji shook his head. He must still be tired. He knew he was still disoriented. "So," said Azalin, "what's your damage, anyhow?" Sayanji blinked at her. "I beg your pardon?" "You didn't just wake up one morning and decide, 'I think I'll become a violently antisocial creepazoid,' did you?" "No." "Well then, what happened?" He scowled at her. "Okay, fine," she said. "Be like that. You're never going to feel better if you don't talk about it." The food arrived then, forestalling further conversation on the subject, and Sayanji discovered that she had, indeed, ordered a lot of food for just the two of them. Fortunately, they both appeared to be ravenously hungry, and demolished it with a curiously companionable ease. They didn't say very much during the carnage, being too occupied with it. Afterward, more silence, as Azalin paid the check and kept looking at him with those gold eyes. Their scrutiny made Sayanji a little uncomfortable, but not as much as he thought, after a bit of consideration, they should have made him, which made him a little uneasy in itself. The oddest thing about it all was that he realized, as he cracked his fortune cookie, that he might be getting to like her. He crunched half of the cookie thoughtfully, smoothed the slip of paper between thumb and forefinger, and read, "Find your enemies, and you will know your friends." "Hmm," he said. "Hmm?" Azalin replied. "I must have received someone else's fortune," he said. "Let me see," she said, and he handed it across the table. "Hmm," she agreed, having read it. "Why do you say it must be someone else's?" Sayanji downed the last of his tea and said, "Someone I once knew told me that a man who believes in friendship is a fool," which wasn't really an answer. "Sounds like he was a real barrel of laughs," Azalin replied, handing back the fortune. "Hmm," said Sayanji noncommittally as he tucked it away in the top pocket of his borrowed jumpsuit. To demonstrate that he wasn't all that concerned about it, he ate the rest of the cookie. Nothing more was said on the cab ride back to campus. Sayanji followed her back into Riley Hall and up to 212, not so much because he wanted to go with her as because he didn't know what else to do. He was sort of on autopilot, still tired, more so now that he was full of food, and still sore, and still cold, even after all that. In some hazy part of his mind, he was starting to wonder if he would ever feel warm again. She took a look at his dull eyes as she led him into 212 and said, "You look beat. Go back to bed." Numbly, he obeyed, taking off his shoes. Without thinking about it, he slipped out of the jumpsuit, too, hung it over the back of the chair, and climbed into her bed. He was out almost as soon as he touched the pillow, but he didn't go very far. His sleep was troubled, jumbled imagery from the days and weeks before his translation rattling around inside his head. Azalin shut off the lights and watched him sleep, muttering and tossing. She wondered what could have happened to him to bring him to such a state, for over the course of the evening she'd gotten the impression that he had once been, or had the potential to be, a pretty together kind of guy. It was kind of pathetic to see him like this, obviously tortured by something, brought low by who knew what. Before long he started shivering again, either because he was really still cold, or because some part of his dreamscape had brought him back to the freezing nights he'd so recently left behind. Whatever it was, it set its teeth in him and wouldn't let go, racking him violently enough to rattle the bed frame. Suddenly, before Azalin could do anything about it, Sionji bolted upright, clutching at his head and screaming, "Stop it!" She was at his side in an instant, holding his shoulders, telling him it was all right and he was safe. It seemed the right thing to say, given the circumstances. He panted, staring around into the darkness of the room for a few seconds, before coming back to himself and relaxing a little in her embrace, wiping his hands down his sweat-stippled face. "Where am I?" he asked her in a soft, pain-soaked voice. Azalin did her best to explain. It wasn't very good and only confused him further, so she told him to stay put, threw on her coat, and went across to Morgan Hall. She shouldn't have been able to get in. It was past curfew and not the right dorm, but she had a copy of Caitlin's keycard and permission from her, if not the campus police, to use it. It only took her a few minutes of poking around to find the thing she was looking for on Utrina's bookshelf, and she knew its owner wouldn't grudge her its use. Tucking it into her coat, she slipped back to her own room and handed it to Sionji, who she found still sitting up in bed with his forehead in his hands. "Here," she said, "read this. It explains everything a lot better than I could." So he switched on the bedside lamp and started reading Derek Bacon's "So You've Just Arrived from a Parallel Dimension." He was a fast reader. Azalin didn't have to amuse herself for too long before he closed the back cover of the book, put it down, and sat with his head turned to the right, looking out the window at the alien constellations in the night sky above the faculty lot. "Another world," Sionji murmured. "But why? Why have I been brought here?" "What's the last thing you remember from where you were?" she asked.
I was crossing the Great Desert."
Azalin climbed up onto the foot of the bed, curled herself into the lotus position, and sat with her elbows on her knees and her chin in her hands. "Maybe you should start at the beginning." So, without really knowing why he was doing it, Sionji did. He told her about the academy, and the tournament, the duelist's code and the rose bride, and all the infinite convolutions of what had turned out to be a tremendous and terrible lie. He told her about Toga, and a dark afternoon in a church, about the deputy chairman and something eternal. As he talked, the things fell into better order in his head. The mysterious attacks on the student council by those close to them, the car, the highway to the end of the world. So much manipulation, so much confusion, so much pain. And all for what? Nothing, as it turned out. But he had come to accept that. He could live with it. After his and Toga's final failed attempt to avert the inevitable, he had come to terms with his own powerlessness in the matter. He'd even, after putting that behind him, started feeling good about himself again, getting back into form, retrenching his swordsmanship and his studies after all the time wasted on the tournament. Until that day... when? 2 weeks ago? 3? The day when the letters had come. "This is ridiculous," said Nanami Kiryu peevishly. "I thought we were through with this idiocy." "You didn't have to come," observed tall, cool Juri Arisugawa, dryly, turning a sardonic emerald look on the fuming blonde. "Neither did you," Nanami replied. "Didn't I hear you say once that you weren't interested in these games any longer?" "Lack of interest in the proceedings doesn't preclude curiosity," said Juri. "Indeed," said Miki Kaworu, nodding. "I, for one, am very curious as to what the End of the World thinks he can accomplish by trying to revive the tournament with no Rose Bride." "I'm not," Nanami grumbled. "I just want this to stop." "Has anyone actually read theirs?" Miki wondered, noticing that the envelopes he, Juri, and Nanami had put down on the table were all still sealed. "I have," said Sionji from the doorway. He strode out onto the balcony, his face impassive, and tossed another of the envelopes, this one with its seal broken, on top of the others. "So what does it say?" Nanami wanted to know. Another one joined them, also open, and Toga Kiryu stepped past Sionji. "It's an invitation." "To what?" asked Nanami. "Dinner," Toga replied, smiling calmly. "Dinner? Who with? The End of the World?" "Yes." Miki triggered his stopwatch. There was a long, brittle silence. "Well, I'm not going," said Nanami. "Nor I," Juri agreed. Miki nodded. Even Sionji made an agreeing noise.